This is The Guardian.
Starmer has got to denounce Corbyn and show his backing for Ukraine. Well, frankly, he's not fit to be Prime Minister.
I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. I want a reform win.
You're richer than the king. I don't believe that you understand how hard it is for people to support food banks.
Yeah, this is I'll just briefly tell you this. You'll find this funny, Jules. So
I can tell you now, they are queuing up in Calais, waiting for a Starmer government so they can come here and stay here.
Oh, but that is the choice.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. So we're finally here, the beginning of the final week, Kieran, of the election campaign, which feels like it's been going on forever, doesn't it?
Forever, and yet somehow it's also flown by. It's been one of those weird campaigns which has been full of noise, but not actually much change, I think, in the overall mood of the campaign.
Well, certainly Labour seemed to have stepped up a gear, I feel, in the last few days. I was at a rally on Saturday night in central London with Keir Starmer and some of the top team, and it was very upbeat. There was a performance by a singer called Lapsley, who the teens in my life hadn't heard of, but I'm sure it is a, you know, a rising star. She sang her song Better Times. I wondered whether that was maybe the Labour Party's new anthem.
Well, on the same day at Glastonbury, I was watching footage of D-Ream playing Things Can Only Get Better.
Right.
They brought Professor Brian Cox on. I did wonder whether they might try and dash down to the Labour rally, but apparently not. They're not
too far away. No, not anymore. Lapsley obviously is currently the artiste in favour. But it was quite funny because she was standing on this stage in the middle of all these activists, and Keir Starmer, his wife Victoria, Angie Rayner, all on one side. And then at the back was Rachel Reeves, her sister Ellie Reeves, and various other politicians. Sadiq Khan was there. And I think it's really telling watching politicians when they dance or when they listen to live music.
Oh, I hate it.
They all got on their feet. They started clapping. You won't be surprised to hear that Angie Rayner was going for it.
Okay,
I mean, you'd expect that. We've seen
her
on stage DJing before and stuff, haven't we? And Rachel Reeves was doing a bit of a sway, actually. She was in her suit and her heels, you know, a bit of a shimmy. Well, it wasn't really sort of nightclub style manoeuvres, but nevertheless, she was having a wee bit of a jig. Keir Starmer was more of a toe-tapping, hand-clapping rather than proper dancing. Although his wife, Vic, was looking quite into it. So, but it was very much sort of very upbeat mood. I wondered when I went to it whether they would have to be a little bit careful not to appear, we've had all through this campaign, all this stuff from them about not being complacent, not looking like they're saying that they're definitely going to win, even though that's what the polls seem to suggest. And of course, there's always that sort of the horror of the Neil Kinnock rally in 92. Are we all right? You know, and it's suggesting that they were definitely going to make it to power. That has haunted Labour people for, you know, decades since. So it wasn't sort of triumphalist, but it definitely was hopeful. And they had all these endorsements from various celebs, including Elton John, who was beamed in from California with his husband, David Furnish, to say that it was time to back Labour. So they seemed
He'll be casting a postal vote, will he, then, presumably?
Presumably he already has. You know? But I interviewed Keir Starmer beforehand, which is out in The Guardian now, that interview. And we knew that there was going to be celeb endorsement. And I said to him, bearing in mind he'd been at Taylor Swift's concert last week, I said to him, who's the celeb endorsement? Can you tell me? I promise I won't tell anyone beforehand. Is it Taylor Swift? And he kind of laughed and suggested that I might end up being disappointed. I mean, I suppose there's a point as well that she's not a British citizen, so wouldn't have a post office.
That would have been a moment. That would have been quite a good moment. I mean, you're saying that, you know, Labour were haunted by visions of Neil Kinnock and the famous Sheffield rally in 92. I think they should have also been haunted by the footage of Hillary Clinton in 1996. Do you remember this? In Chicago? Dancing La Macarena. In fact, the entire Democratic Party at their convention. And it's one of those pieces of footage that people had forgotten about, but then went viral a few years ago.
Or maybe that's why Keir Starmer wasn't properly dancing at this central
Just
London
don't
rally.
Don't try and dance the Macarena. That will be my my primary lesson. But so, okay, so you interviewed him as well. I remember you interviewed him a few weeks ago, also on the campaign trail, and said that he'd been surprisingly relaxed, I think. Mm-hmm. Was he even more so? What was his
mood? Yeah, he was pretty relaxed, although there was one quite funny moment where in the space of about 60 seconds, three different people came into the room that we were in, one to deliver coffee, one to deliver hot water, and somebody else to deliver some oat milk or something like that. And he was eventually he was going, oh, for goodness sake, it's like trying to do an interview in a bus station, you know, people coming and going. But Keir Starmer is relaxed isn't the first word that you would naturally attribute to Keir Starmer, because he is a serious person. And when you interview him, he does, you know, he gives detailed, thoughtful answers. And you almost feel a bit bad asking him for, you know, a quick answer on the Middle East peace process or something, expecting him to answer in 30 seconds. And, you know, for much of the interview, I focused on how the Labour Party can begin to address some of the sort of the disillusionment and disaffection that there is towards politics right across the board, not necessarily one political party, though the Tories obviously have been, with some of the scandals that they've gone through, have been in the firing line for much of this. But it's been a kind of plague on all your houses. And one thing that we've talked about this before, Kieran, that we have all picked up on the doorstep, and candidates we've spoken to have picked up on the doorstep, is this sense of people not really feeling engaged with politics, feeling that there aren't any answers, that nothing is going to get better despite the promises from all the political parties. So I asked him how he, if he makes it to number 10, was planning to deal with that. And, you know, he said he acknowledged that hope had been kicked out of some people, as he put it. And he said he's not surprised that people feel disaffected, but stressed how important it was that it was restored. And it, really, there was two things. One was him saying, look, we need to show people that it's not just about words, it's also about action. And that we will give them hope, but it has to be credible, realisable, and not fantastical. So it has to be sort of delivering the things that we've said we're going to deliver, just to make a sort of very tangible difference. And then the other part of it was sort of like the standards piece, and the fact that people feel that politicians are in it for themselves and, you know, behave badly, and they need to make sure that they're accountable, really. And he was very clear that if any of his ministers were found in breach of the ministerial code, they've got to go. And I said, well, what, even Rachel Reeves, your shadow chancellor or would-be chancellor? He said, we can't make any exceptions. If you do, you've lost your anchor. In the end, it's about deeds, not words. So, you know, it's early days, right? And we don't know, well, first of all, they need to win, and then we need to see what they do. But he gave the example, which I thought was quite interesting, of when he came into power, when he took over the Labour Party and made that early pledge that the first thing he would do was rid it of anti-Semitism. There's a lot of people who are kind of like, well, that's never going to happen. But he proved them wrong. And I guess what he was saying was, I did it for the Labour Party, I can now do it for the country. But people are just going to have to, you know, that we need to move very quickly. We, the Labour Party, need to move very quickly to show people that we mean what we say.
It's funny, you were talking about how much he doesn't like giving short answers to questions, or rather kind of how guilty you feel asking.
I've just been wanging for too long there, Kieran.
No, that wasn't what I was going to say. No, but one of the most interesting things for me, and most revealing things for me about Keir Starmer during the campaign, has been how much he hates the quick fire round questions. You know, do you prefer, it's just something, but do you know, porridge or cereal for breakfast? And each time he just looks excruciatingly kind of embarrassed and tangled up by it. And he started saying to interviews, I hate these. I really just don't like these. You know, this should be the relatively easy bit where you get to loosen up and go a bit, you know, go a bit off message. He just doesn't.
But they're
like
telling, aren't they? Because
telling.
It's people's instinct to sort of go for one thing or the other, you know, the pub or wine bar, or, you know, a steak or quinoa. But actually, people read so much into those answers. And I think he probably is overthinking it, whereas he just needs to say, oh, football rather than rugby. And I think he probably needs to be, just trust his instincts.
Well, even when he goes off script, he tends to be scripted. So I remember doing a participating in a briefing with him and Rachel Reeves about the Green Prosperity Plan, where he obviously felt the need to lighten the mood a bit. It was quite a tense briefing about when they were in the middle of their U-turn. And so he tried a joke, which was somebody asked him whether he and Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, were at odds over this. And he said, you know, the only thing we disagree over is how much I talk about football. And it was so obviously scripted. We all in the room just kind of cringed and thought, well, you don't need to do that. Just, you know, if you're going to make a joke, try and loosen up. But anyway, that's just who he is, right?
Yeah. And the other, I should just quickly say, the other part of the interview, which I thought was really striking, was that it wasn't just about we need to restore hope and trust and faith in British politics. It was a warning that if Labour fails to do that, then they're going to have to deal with the rise of the populist right is happening anyway, but that could become a bigger problem. And that sort of disaffection is a driver to populism and nationalism, not just here, but it's happening across Europe. We're seeing it most obviously in France, but also Germany and Italy. And of course, looking further over the Atlantic, the other direction, to the States. And, you know, he told me he was concerned about that. And, you know, that sort of underlined to him why it was so important that progressive parties didn't just kind of say, oh, to people that were sort of attracted to the likes of Reform, oh, you're wrong, the world isn't like that, but that they actually moved towards them and addressing their concerns and actually showing them that they could do something about it. So, you know, there was a sort of a longer term, more serious argument as well, beyond just the sort of the initial vote for us and we can make everything sort of happy and shiny again.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we've been talking about in the last couple of days is just trying to remember previous campaigns and what they felt like at this stage as you go into the run-in for the last few days, you know, especially when you look at a change of government. What was the mood? What were the signals you were getting from various places about what was about to happen? And over the weekend, the Sunday Times became the first of the Murdoch papers to flip from backing the Conservatives to backing Labour, which I think is an important moment. Although, you know, the words that they used in their leader column were, I think, quite hedged.
Lukewarm
is probably the right word. It's basically that the Tories have run out of steam and now's the time for Labour, despite all the misgivings we have.
Yeah, they said we judge that on balance, Starmer has earned his chance.
Yeah.
resounding endorsement.
One of the interesting things I was thinking about and kind of looking at the papers in their last week or so of coverage is the right-leaning papers have kind of ramped up, I think, their warnings about an incoming Labour government. Mm-hmm. And they've all been largely talking about the same thing. I mean, a lot of it about tax. And in the last couple of days, it's been Keir Starmer will bankrupt the country. And I think there has been some commentary around that saying that, look, this is almost, you know, the papers who are losing influence. And I think it's fair to say that lots of newspapers across the industry are losing influence as people turn to other forms of media, kind of howling at the moon. This is the last dying screams of outrage of an industry that's losing its influence. And I was thinking, well, what was it like in 97? Wasn't it the case that all those Murdoch papers, all those right-leaning papers were backing Labour because they saw the writing on the wall? And this time they're kind of stubbornly refusing to do so. But actually it wasn't like that. And I went back and had a look at which papers backed Labour in 97. The Times, very tellingly, didn't back Labour in 97, only changed in 2001. The Express, the same, changed in 2001. The Mail have never backed Labour. And then, of course, there was the big moment where the Sun came out for Blair in the run-up to that election. But, I mean, you've been looking, haven't you, at some of the coverage just before the 97 election, and I think you think it's quite similar to what we're seeing at the moment.
It was very similar front pages. I mean, there's one very striking Mail front page, which was pretty much replicated, however many years on it is, 27 years on.
Yeah, about the undecided voters.
Yeah, this week. So, you know, a lot of it's been very similar. But I did spot one thing in during my trawl of the papers, Kieran, and I thought I would just read out. This is an excerpt, in fact, from The Times about an election. It says, and it references a senior Labour politician who I'm not going to name, I'm going to call Mr. X. And it says, although most people expect a clear victory for Mr. X, there is little evidence of positive enthusiasm for Labour or of high expectations of what the party would do in office. The safety first minimalism of the Labour campaign fits the state of the nation. Now, you might be thinking that Mr. X is Keir Starmer, because we've had so many newspaper articles saying, you know, he's too cautious, he's being too careful, what's Labour going to be able to deliver in government? Nobody's enthusiastic about Labour on the doorstep. But it's not. Mr. X is, in fact, Tony Blair. And this article is not unique. When I was looking through some of these previous copies of all sorts of different papers, The Observer, The Times, The Guardian, The Sun, there was a similar theme. And I think what we forget in retrospect, because, you know, we think about, you know, cool Britannia and the world was a happier place and everything was much rosier and cheerier, we kind of like view it through rose-tinted spectacles about what people were saying beforehand. And actually, there was also in the days after that massive Labour landslide of 1997, there was a similar vein. There was still there was still journalists, columnists writing, saying we're all set for a disappointment. Will they make it to, you know, past one term? So there are definitely, I know it's a different world and, you know, obviously the economy is entirely different from the one that New Labour inherited in 1997. But it did kind of make me stop short and think, oh, actually, hang on a sec, there are more parallels here than you might necessarily expect.
And what do you think about the overall question of whether it matters anymore, you know, A, who the papers endorse, and B, just what they say generally? I mean, how much do we matter? How much does that kind of, that bulk of Fleet Street, that kind of Tory-facing flank of newspapers that have always been able to set the news agenda in this country, are they still able to do so, do you think, in the same way?
Well, I think if you think that millions of people are sitting down and reading what the editorial line for the election is in the Telegraph or the Times or the Sun or even the Guardian, I think you're probably wrong. But where I think it does matter is the tone that it sets in their news coverage, because what still drives election campaigns is the stories on the front page. And some of those stories are, you know, things that politicians do that we report on, like Rishi Sunak coming back early from D-Day or the Labour Party's handling of Diane Abbott's election. But others, and our betting story, our gambling story is a prime example of this. Others are stories which newspapers themselves come up with, and they make a decision on how they promote them, whether they put it on the front page, whether they follow them up, based on their editorial line. And so for us at The Guardian to run a story about the £100 bet that Rishi Sunak's closest parliamentary aide put on the election on the front page and follow the story up day after day after day, would we have done that if we were the Daily Mail? Probably not this close to an election.
Yeah, you're right. It kind of almost sets the mood music, doesn't it? Yeah. And it shapes what people talk about more than anything else. And I know that people say, hey, look, news consumers go elsewhere these days. They're much more paying attention to, obviously to their phones, but to TikTok or Instagram or BBC News Alerts or Apple News. But almost everything you see in mainstream media is still formed, shaped by newspaper coverage.
So as we have just a few days left until polling day, it feels like we should reflect on what we've learned about the parties over the course of this campaign, and not just about the parties, but like the state of them right now. And, you know, I've spent quite a lot of time either with Keir Starmer or the Labour Party over the last few weeks. And I guess my big takeaway is, while we all knew that they were being pretty disciplined, I'm not sure I expected them to maintain that all the way through. And they're ruthlessly focused on their aims of getting elected. You know, that over and above anything else, and that might sound a bit obvious, a truism, but actually when you think how they could have been distracted from that course on countless occasions, they've stuck to the campaign that they wanted to run rather than being forced into responding either beyond the tax stuff to lots of Tory attacks or sort of moving on to the Tory territory. And I actually asked Starmer about this, but in relation to why they hadn't taken the fight more to Nigel Farage. And he said, look, for 4.5 years, I've had people saying to me, go faster, go slower, look over there, deal with this. And the only reason, quoting him, that we're in the position we're in is because I knew 4.5 years ago where I needed to be. And that's my lodestar. And I think I've seen that more evidently throughout this campaign than I ever had done before, that he has a focus, and my God, he's ruthlessly disciplined about sticking to it. And what's going to be really interesting is how that transfers, if all the polls are right and they end up in government with a chunky majority, how that transfers to government and his leadership style. It's not just about, of course, how he is in power, but how others respond to him. And what's going to be interesting to watch is whether he's able, when he has all these, you know, huge amounts of things in his in-tray and party management and the state of the country and international affairs, whether he's able to maintain that discipline or whether actually it's too much and he's pushed back against by his own party, whether that's ministers running their own departments or backbench MPs who feel it's too suffocating, it's too much. And we've seen what happens in the past when party management breaks down. You know, I think they're going to have to keep an eye on that one as well.
Yeah, you know, managing a small majority is difficult, but managing a large one is difficult as well, because you've got A, people have a sense of security that the party is in a strong position now and they can afford to take a few risks. But B, you've got a lot of people wanting jobs. And there are only so many jobs to go around. I mean, if he does come back with 450 MPs or whatever some of the MRPs are saying, how on earth is he going to keep all those people happy? I mean, he'll either have to be doing reshuffles every other week or they're going to have to invent some jobs or he's going to have a lot of...
Maybe these mission boards will have lots and lots of seats on them and they can MPs all...
Yeah, well, it's not a bad idea. The thing that surprised me, though, is less Labour. It's been the Tories. And I think we've talked about this before, but when the election was called, First of all, I expected the polls to narrow during the campaign. Second of all, the reason for that was I thought that when confronted with almost existential risk, the Tories would rally round and fight hard. They would show unity that they haven't shown in the last 2 years, because that's what the Tories do. They fight hard, they win elections. They are nothing if they're not an election-winning machine. And it just hasn't happened. That sense of life has never been there from the Tory campaign. And I tell you, one thing that I think has been really telling is how few of the front bench has been out there doing media rounds. You know, the number of times now that we've seen Mel Stride doing the Today programme and the TV shows and a bit of Grant Shapps and a bit of David Cameron, but almost nobody else. And it just feels like the heart of the Tory party is not in this election. And we're seeing this over, you know, the last few days, especially. It is in the leadership contest to come. And that has really taken me aback. And I think that had the party decided, look, we'll worry about the leadership afterwards. Our real foe is the Labour Party. Let's all just do everything we can. I think they might have closed the gap a little bit. Had they presented a unified front? Had they felt that sense of urgency, even that Labour did in 2010? And I remember there was a moment just before the election in 2010. There was a rally at Central Methodist Hall. It was organised. It was organised by a community organising group called Citizens UK. And they got David Cameron and Gordon Brown to turn up at this. And Gordon Brown gave one of the speeches of his life. I mean, it's utterly compelling, tub-thumping speech about everything that Labour had done to tackle poverty and what they would do in the next term. And you just had that sense of, OK, we know we're on our uppers. We know we're probably going to lose. But my God, do we think this is important? We're really, really going to fight. I just never felt like that fight was in the Tory campaign.
This election campaign's been so different from the one you mentioned in 2010 and indeed the ones in 2015, 2017 and 2019, because it feels like it's been so much more controlled by the centre of both parties. Yeah. And we've barely, you know, we've seen them in TV debates, but we've not seen politicians wandering down the street talking to members of the public, presumably because both of the main parties thought that that would be too risky for them. Yeah. We've not seen mass rallies where, you know, members of the public could sort of shout out from the floor and interrupt what was generally been a carefully written, carefully crafted, carefully managed event. I think the election campaign has been less impactful because of that. And there's this feeling that the politicians are not just hiding away from some of the big questions about, you know, what the economy is going to be like afterwards and public spending cuts and all of those things, but they're also hiding away from the public. And I think that is not good for
the way that democracy
works.
That feeds into that public feeling of disillusionment, doesn't it? Because people just think they're not even being really listened to in an election campaign. And for me, the other really interesting question, and this comes up every campaign, is whether campaigns matter at all. Because there is a theory that campaigns don't do anything, that all they do is crystallise what people were probably going to do anyway. But there is one thing I think during this campaign that has run counter to that. And that's, even while the gap between Tories and Labour has stayed absolutely doggedly at 20 points, both parties have lost support, which really doesn't tend to happen during an election campaign. Usually you talk about the third party squeeze when people start to focus on who's going to form the next government. They decide on one of the two main parties. And exactly the opposite has happened during the past 5 weeks. So you've seen Labour and the Tories fall and the Lib Dems, Reform and Greens rise during that course. And I think that is exactly what you're talking about. That is the public saying we're not being listened to here. And even if there's something really big at stake in this election, we're willing to vote for one of these smaller parties if you're just simply going to ignore us. And I think the one really to watch out for is Reform. And we've talked about this a little bit, but this could be a really historic election in terms of that part of UK politics. Call it the hard right, the far right, whatever you want to call it. They've obviously tried to make inroads before. UKIP had some success, failed, obviously had massive success with the referendum. But I wonder whether we're going to look back on this election as the moment where Reform got a real
stronghold in British electoral democracy, parliamentary democracy. And I think one of the big questions that's going to have to be answered after the election is, especially on the Tory side, what do you want to do about this threat? Because the new Tory leader, whoever they are, is going to have to decide either to try and ally themselves, to turn the Tories into a kind of Farageist party, either bring him inside the tent or do some kind of deal, you know, even, dare I say it, get subsumed by Reform, or whether they're going to stand up and say, no, sorry, our party is something different. And I think if they don't do the latter, if they try and, you know, make themselves into some version of Reform, this could be, I don't know, I hesitate to say the end of the Tory party, but the end of the Tory party as we know it.
Well, we don't have long to wait to find out how it all plays out. And that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. Our next episode will be on Friday, the 5th of July. We'll have been up all night covering the election. We'll be joined then by John Harris, going through all the drama from the day. And I also wanted to let you know about a special event on 5th of July at 7:30 p.m. The Guardian Newsroom Election Results Special. You can join our colleagues Hugh Muir, Gabby Hinsliffe, John Crace, Jonathan Friedland and Zoe Williams for analysis of the results. And they'll be taking your questions too. Book a ticket at theguardian.live. This episode was produced by Alex Atack, music by Axel Cloutier, and the executive producers Amaz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson. Goodbye.
See you on the other side.